The discussion last time was about computing the correlation functions in Lorentzian signature. And along the way, we encountered also the problem of analyzing singular behavior, differential equations. And in particular, we had this example of a scalar field in ADS d plus one, right? So we had this example of ADS d plus one, and the minimally coupled scalar, not necessarily massless scalar, minimally coupled scalar. And by the way, the people who I mentioned various things that perhaps not every single person in the room is familiar with. But when you say minimally coupled, if you want to explore what this means and what would mean non-minimally coupled, then ask me or find out yourself. This is not difficult to find out. So the equation of motion was written on the board, and we had the solution, which was of the following form, was some coefficient which depends on the momentum, and then z to power, let me call it delta minus, and then there is another coefficient b of k, and a second solution which started with z to power, let's call me delta plus. And delta plus was d over 2 plus nu, where nu was related to the mass in the following way. It was d squared over 4 plus m squared l squared. And delta minus was d minus delta plus. Now, this situation is fairly typical for ADS, but in fact it's fairly typical simply for analyzing the ODEs with a number of singular points. And we talked yesterday about the classification of ordinary differential equations of the type y double prime, for example, of z plus a, which can depend on some parameters, but let me, so this A in principle depends on Z and some parameters of the differential equation. Y prime plus B also is a function of Z, Y equal to zero. And the example of such an equation was the equation for a minimally coupled scalar in ADSD, but I don't want to bother, so let's specialize for d equals 4, right? So we have ADS 5 example, right? Just to illustrate, remember we had this mode equation fk double prime minus 3 over z f prime k minus, and here there is this p is k squared plus m squared l squared over z squared. And fk. So the exercise that is partially in your tutorials and probably appear again on Thursday it's a standard thing that you have to do when you encounter the ODE. So we looked at the singular points. So in this case, the singular points were obviously identifiable. So there is one at z equal 0. So the coefficient is singular there, and coefficient here is singular there. So this singular point is regular. Well, doesn't sound very, very well, but that's a classification not invented by me. So it's a regular singularity because the behavior of coefficient A is no worse than a simple pole, and the behavior of coefficient B is no worse than a double pole at z equals 0. There is also a singular point at infinity, But let's not worry about it. So z equal to infinity is also a regular singular point. But here you check this by doing the change of variables. W is equal to 1 over z, and then look at behavior at then W is equal to 0. So one thing that I want to emphasize for people who didn't have this experience before is that you build the Frobenius. So if you have a regular singularity, then you build the Frobenius solutions, which are convergent series around this singular point, with the coefficients which are derivable from simply from differential equation. So the coefficients are known, the Frobenius solutions are always of the type. So here, so generically, for this type of equation, so you have y of z. is z to some power alpha, and then there is a series, some coefficients a n, z to power n. So this is a power series around z equals 0, but in general z minus z naught, where z naught is a singular point, and the coefficients a n do not depend on z, but they depend on parameters of differential equations such as k and m, for example. Now these coefficients alpha, the indices of differential equation are found by making an ansatz of this type and substituting it into the differential equation. So for the case of z equal 0 singularity, we just substitute, so f of k of z, for example, is z to power alpha, and then there is an infinite series with increasing powers of z, but the minimal one that coefficient that we have in the series is z to power alpha, right? So plus and so on, and if you substitute it here, what you will get is from double derivative there you have the alpha, right? And you differentiate again, you have alpha minus one. Z to power alpha minus 2 plus higher orders in z, then from this second coefficient it will be minus 3 divided by z. So and there is one derivative of z, so it will be alpha, right? And it would be z to power alpha minus 1, but it is divided by z, so it will still z to power alpha minus 2 plus higher orders of in z, and finally here. When you substitute z to power alpha in front of k squared, so this will be of order z to alpha, right? It's a higher order than z to alpha minus 2, so we can ignore this. In other words, in the limit of z going to 0, the dominant term at the singularity will be this one, which includes mass. So it will be minus m squared, so minus m squared l squared. And then there is z to power alpha minus 2 plus higher orders. And this whole thing is supposed to be equal to 0 because this is the equation. And the higher, so the highest, the coefficient in front of the highest, or the most singular term in this equation would give you a quadratic equation minus m squared l squared equal to 0. And this is quadratic equation with two roots, which will give you these coefficients delta plus and delta minus in this particular case. So these are two, right? So let's for a moment, let's not bother with m. So let's put m to 0. Then you have equation alpha minus 1 minus 3 alpha equal to 0. And it is possible to solve it in real time. Right, so that will be alpha squared minus 4 alpha equal to 0, or alpha minus 4 equal to 0 with two roots, alpha equals 0 and alpha equal to 4. So in this case of a minimally coupled massless scalar, and if mass is not equal to 0, then you get the square root, right? So but I don't want to bother with it. So Then you have delta plus the largest of these two indices is equal to 4, and delta minus is equal to 0. Right, so that's our solution for the massless scalar. And if you remember from lectures before, we actually wrote the exact solution for this equation in terms of the Bessel functions or modified Bessel functions depending on the sign of k squared. And if you expand the Bessel functions, and you discover that there will be the expansion will start with a coefficient which is a constant, right, plus high order of some z, and then the second solution will have a dependence, a small z, will have a dependence which starts with z to the fourth, and then higher order of some z. Okay, so that is an illustration of the general case, which is represented by this expansion here. So this expansion we'll be dealing with, and again, so this is consistent with all of this, right? So let's try to see if d is equal to 4. Then MS is equal to 0, right? Then here we have 16 over 4 is 4, so nu is equal to 2. 2 plus 2 is equal to 4, so delta plus indeed is equal to 4. And delta minus is 4 minus 4 is 0, right? So this is consistent with what is written here. In massive case, it will be slightly more complicated with the square root, but the philosophy is clear. Right? So this is all Frobenius theory of ODEs, sort of applied to this particular case. It is a simple thing. It's philosophically simple thing. But one can extract from this Frobenius theory a number of interesting consequences, which we might discuss later. In particular, consequences which are relevant for these things which are related to the so-called holographic renormalization, because you may wonder. So you already understand that essentially what happened in this whole scenario was that the gauge theory non-trivial information about your dual quantum field theory is encoded into the metric of your space-time and dynamics of fields, because these fluctuations, they interact with each other generically. In this case, it's just a single minimal coupled massless scalar. It's not interacting with other fluctuations, but in more general case, of course, all of these fields are coupled. But the point is that these fluctuations of this background somehow carry information about the correlation functions and therefore about the full spectrum of your quantum field theory and properties of your dual QFT, and this is encoded in a set of partial differential equations generically. But if you consider the simplest case in which time plays no role essentially, right? So the background is static. You don't have anything like gravitational collapse or any complicated dynamical set of equations. Then it is simply encoded in a set of ODEs. And the ODEs would tell you various things because this is 19th century sort of mathematics. You know already by looking at these Frobenius expansions, for example, that if you carefully analyze the terms in this expansion, then they would tell you that this equation knows about the local properties of the solution. Right? Remember that you have a number of singular points in the complex plane, and you can always, if these points are regular singular points, then you can always find the local solution around them in the form of convergent Frobenius series. So these series carry information about the local properties, right? Because the coefficient of these series, these ans, are they can be read off from the equation. More or less automatically, you can write a program in Mathematica which computes as many of them as you, well, let's say many of them, right? So, right. But in some fortunate cases, like the hypergeometric equation or Bessel equation and so on, you can actually derive the exact expression for any coefficient an. So for example, if you're talking about the differential equation for the exponent, right, you know that an is equal to 1 over n factorial, right, and you, for any n. More generically, to find the recursive formula for, so effectively what happens when you substitute this into the differential equation, you reduce your differential equation to the equation in finite differences, right? Because you have the equation of a type an plus 2 with some coefficient plus an plus 1 with some coefficient plus an is equal to 0. And solving such an equation is, in principle, no easier than solving the original differential equation. Okay, so that's not a, however, formally speaking, all of these coefficients can be computed, but this is not a solution still, because unless you have the formula which gives all of them to infinity without kind of doing next step, like we, in the case of the exponent, you have 1 over n factorial, right, and you don't have to do any work to determine a coefficient which is a with 1 million, right, or something like that. Right? So to find a solution, you need to know the connection problem. And we talked about this last time, so that means determining this a and b, so that the boundary conditions on the other on the other end of your interval, for example, or at other singular point, is satisfied. And then you do that. So the form of the solution would tell you which. So some pieces of the solution will carry the local information about a singular point. And some pieces will carry the global information that would depend on the boundary condition at the other end. So for simplicity, let's talk about two points, one at the boundary, z equals 0, and another one at z equal to infinity, for example, which is a horizon. In this case, it's Poincaré horizon. So in the solution, in generic solution of differential equation, in the series, there will be a number of points that would carry information about the local behavior of the solution near z equals 0. And all other coefficients will carry information about the global properties of the solution between 0 and infinity. And it turns out that the coefficients which carry information about the local properties, these are exactly the coefficients which you have to deal with via holographic renormalization. So these are coefficients which you usually remove by including the counter terms into your solution. And that is natural because these are coefficients which carry information. So later on, we will talk about the connection between the ultraviolet behavior of your dual theory and infrared behavior. And this will be encoded into the picture of dual gravity, so that the behavior near the boundary would correspond to ultraviolet behavior. So your boundary corresponds to, so this is z equal to epsilon going to 0. This, you can think of it as the ultraviolet cutoff in your theory, or inverse ultraviolet cutoff, right? So taking which to infinity, meaning taking epsilon to 0, would take you to the conformal fixed point of your theory. So so some local information will be encoded into these coefficients, and this local information, just like in renormalizing your theory, would tell you what are the ultraviolet pieces that you don't know. I mean, you have no control over them, and they don't depend on the infrared properties or intermediate energy properties of your theory, and they have to be taken care of by including the counter terms. All right, so this is an illustration again for computing this delta plus and delta minus, right? And now, let's come back to a couple of other remarks before we go to the next topic. Are following? Remember, so we're talking about the fields propagating in curved space time, and ADS can be equipped with the inner product which is defined as follows: the usual inner product defined in curved space-time. So I appeal to Burrell Davis or any other appropriate textbook on how to quantize. So you quantize the fields on certain background. So GT, not necessarily Minkowski space, minus phi 2 dt star 1. And remember, so last time we had this BF bound, so m squared L squared greater or equal minus d squared over 4. And the modes of masses squared above the BF bound are split into two sets relative to this inner product in ADS. So let me write this down. So the modes with m squared above this BF bound are split into two sets. Set number one is, then you have m squared L squared greater or equal to minus d squared over 4, but less than minus d squared over 4 plus 1. And the rest is the upper branch, so to speak, when you have m squared L squared greater or equal to. So there are two branches. Let's call them branch 1 and branch 2. Now, in set number 1, both modes, and both modes, I mean, by both modes, I mean the solution. So we always have two solutions of the second order ODE, right? One that starts with delta plus, and one that starts with delta minus. So both modes, so the ones that start with z to power delta minus or d minus delta in the old notation, and modes proportional to z to power delta, are normalizable. With respect to this inner product. And in set two, so this is set one, but in set two, the modes, the modes which are proportional to z d minus delta are non-normalizable. And the ones with z to power delta are normalizable. I mean, this is slightly unfortunate terminology, but so we consider set two only, but the story that just means that we don't want to spend more time on this. But the story, and if you want to know the story, I can tell you where to look. The story of set one is known. So only looking at set number two. So we have this distinction between a different type of behavior. So this terminology, okay, so it's historically perhaps it's natural. So and people quantize fields on a curved space-time, and of course the kind of you know, if you didn't have experience with that, then perhaps so see this great book by Birrell and Davis. So quantum fields in curved space-time, right? So then with respect to this inner product, you can classify your modes, right? So you want to build a Hilbert space of your theory, right? So just like you do in Minkowski space. So you quantize the theory, you introduce some inner product on a space of solutions of your wave equation. And you do the same in the curved space-time with modulo some difficulties, which of course appear due to the fact that it is curved and many interesting features related to that. But by and large, so you have this inner product, and you can choose out of your modes the set of modes which are normalizable, meaning this thing converges, right? The integral converges. You can actually find a finite norm of these states, right? It's non-normalizable. It means that this thing blows up. And you cannot normalize them, right? So these are solutions. So you have so for masses which are above this bound here, we discover that the modes which starts with delta minus are non-normalizable, and the modes which starts with delta plus are normalizable. Okay, in with respect to this product, the role played by two types of modes is different in ADS CFT, and this is visible from our construction of the correlator already. But let me just reiterate this, that the non-normalizable term in the solution of KZ is a source for the operator O in the boundary action similar to, remember what we had for dilaton, right? So we had this boundary action deformed by the expression that involved the current J, which was our phi naught, the boundary value of our field phi, and then there is this operator O with J of X on the boundary played by effectively by the role of A of X, the coefficient to which our solution reduced. Right, so the case of dilaton delta minus is equal to zero. So this is literally the phi goes at z equals zero. It goes to A, right? And that is interpreted as the source of the operator O. In that case, was traced f mu squared on the boundary. So recall the dilaton example. A dilaton example before, but more generically, J of X. So I mentioned when we discussed a dilaton that generically we had to renormalize our field, bulk field on the boundary. So it's the limit of Z going to zero of Z to power delta minus D. You have to remove this dependence on Z in the lowest order coefficient in Z, minus phi of Z and X. So this thing acts as a source of the operator. All right. So in other words, you have a solution of a, so think of a generic sort of bulk field. You have a solution of that type. It has two pieces. The piece that starts with the lowest power of Z, in this case, it's delta minus, right? I mean, it's called delta minus. Yeah, it could be zero, for example, but it could be something non-zero, not necessarily zero, but it is less than delta plus. So the idea is in this terminology is that delta plus is greater than delta minus. So up to this dependence on Z that is removed by this renormalization, that coefficient A plays the role of the source for the operator whose correlation functions we want to compute. And then the role of and this is by kind of standard terminology in curved space-time, this source of this mode, this part of the solution happened to be a so-called non-normalizable mode. And this is, this is, in my opinion, not a great terminology, but that's something that is used in the literature. So you have to be aware of this fact. So the non-normalizable piece of your wave equation, solution to your wave equation, plays the role of source for the operator. And the normalizable modes play a different role. So because they are normalizable, so you can quantize your theory, your fluctuations in curved space-time, a la Birol Davis. And that means that you can have a Hilbert space in the bulk, right? In the bulk. And this Hilbert space can be identified with Hilbert space in the dual theory. So the moral of the story is that normalizable modes are in the correspondence with the states of the dual theory. And this is visible for, so when we talk about tomorrow, when we talk about finite temperature quantum field theory, when we have a ground which involves a black hole, then we compute. So how do you classify? How do you describe the state in which a theory is? You compute the one-point function, for example, of various operators. So for example, you compute a one-point function of the stress-energy tensor, or you compute a one-point function of some scalar operator or a current or things like that, and they would tell you in what state the theory is. So for example, if you happen to compute the one-point function of the stress-energy tensor correlator, let's say of components, let's say T00, right? It's in some state. So this bracket would mean that you are computing. It could be in vacuum, right? In vacuum, this thing will be zero, right? But if you are working at finite temperature, once you introduce a finite temperature, you break various symmetries, right? In your theory, you break the conformal invariance, but you also break Lorentz invariance, because there is a specific frame of reference where your heat bath has a temperature T. So you break Lorentz invariance as well, and therefore T naught naught is no longer zero, right? You don't expect it to be zero. And in fact, by the meaning of this component of T mu nu, this is supposed to be proportional to the energy density of your theory, and it is. So we will compute, so when you have a finite temperature state of your theory, then a T naught naught will be proportional to something which is which will be interpreted as the energy density of your theory, which in vacuum state will be zero, but for finite temperature, this will be proportional to temperature to the fourth as a gas of photons or gluons, right? That is by dimension analysis, it must be Q to the fourth. Okay, so this means that computing the one-point functions would characterize the state in which a theory is. It could be vacuum, it could be finite temperature, it could be finite density, and so on and so forth. So this is in one-to-one correspondence with normalizable modes of the theory, and one can show, one can show, moreover, that there is a relationship between the expectation value of the operator O in the presence of this current of this source J, and it is related to the coefficient B in front of a normalizable of the solution of a normalizable mode solution. Now, the last remark on this subject is the following: that if you have other wave equations, because we consider it only scalar one, it would be interesting to analyze the fields with more indices than a scalar. And I think tomorrow in tutorial we'll think of analyzing the Maxwell field in AES CFT. But let me just announce that for P forms, the relationship between mass and this delta of the scaling dimension of the correlation function is this one, and you can look at the literature of how to prove this, or you can try to prove this yourself and look at the literature one way or the other. Okay, so now we need another ingredient before we look into the specific fluctuations of stress energy tensor correlator and compute the viscosity. So we need another ingredient in this dictionary. And this ingredient is relating to so-called quasi-normal spectrum. It's a quasi-normal spectrum or modes. And the poles of the retarded correlation function. So this is a simple entry. Recall that G retarded of K is computed by considering linearized fluctuations of the dual gravity background. All right, so we had equations of motion, and we linearized them, and then we can analyze whether or not these equations are decoupled. But we also have to impose these fluctuations, so the special boundary conditions, right? So I remind you that the idea was to have the background field. So here phi denotes all fields, not necessarily a scalar one. So generically, it will be this, right? So you substitute this into the equations of motion. You have either PDE, so generically you have linear. Okay, so it's important. So you have linear, so equation of motion linearize, and you have linear. Generically, it will be linear PDE, but if you have enough symmetry, so you use Fourier transform, right? So nothing is time dependent and so on. So that reduces to a set of ODEs. You have a set of linear differential equations, and with boundary conditions. For example, if you are considering the computation of the retarded correlator, which would be incoming wave, boundary condition at the horizon, and normalized to one, right, and normalized to one, at the boundary. All right, so that's what we consider it. And then the solution had this form A, which is a function of momentum and other parameters, z to power delta minus plus high order, and then you have B of k, and again, it has non-trivial dependence generically on k, with power delta plus, high orders. So if this is a solution of ODE that satisfies, so this is a solution, so this is, if your delta phi background, right, identical to, just called this again, phi again, has this form, then the way you compute the correlator was the following, right? So how you compute the correlator? So you first of all, you construct something which is normalized to one at z equal epsilon, right? And that was done by a simple construction. It's a simple delta plus high orders divided by the same solution at epsilon. Delta minus plus high orders plus b z epsilon to power delta plus high orders. So this is your solution with a property that f k of epsilon is simply equal to one by construction. Okay. Now using this solution, then you compute the correlation function then once you have this, the computation of the correlator as a function of k was to take the solution, substitute it into the action in the of the appropriate fluctuation coming from type 2b supergravity. So you take this solution, you substitute it into the action reduces to the boundary term on shell. And the action, then you take the limit of z equal to epsilon, right? But the action reduces to the boundary term, and this boundary term will include, well, it will include some normalization, right? So n is some normalization such as we had this, what is it, pi squared l to the 8, kappa 10 squared, and so on, right? So things like that. Then there was some power of z, and at z equal to epsilon, it will be epsilon, to some power, let me call it power alpha. And this epsilon would come from things like square root of minus g, and then there was gzz, right? So remember in our case of ADS5, this whole construction gave us 1 over z cube, right, in front of our phi, right? So I will denote it generically by epsilon to power alpha, because that will not play much of a role. But what will play a role is the boundary term, and the boundary term was of the form f minus k of epsilon f prime k computed at epsilon. So this is important. Now f minus k of epsilon doesn't really, again, it's not a very interesting term, because it is normalized. So f k or minus k doesn't matter. It normalized to one at epsilon. So this term at epsilon is simply equal to one. So apart from this not very interesting factors, we are dealing with the computation. So of course this epsilon plays a certain role, because there will be some epsilon dependence here, and you have to see which terms will vanish, which term will blow up, and which terms have to be renormalized using this holographic renormalization or some simpler methods. But the bottom line is that the important information, dynamical information about your correlation function, will be included in f prime. And computing this f prime is a trivial exercise because we know what f is. So f prime is simply we had this construction. So you may wonder. So this construction appears in the computation of the correlation function of a dilaton, which was a very simple example. And you may wonder that, okay, so maybe if I have gravitons and photons in the bulk, perhaps things will go rather differently, right? So we won't have this simple thing. But in fact, we do. So philosophically, so we have seen this for, okay, so. Okay, so we have seen this for the case of a dilaton. Dilaton fluctuation. But it can be shown to be rather generic. But it can be shown to be rather generic. So part of this, I hope you will do in tutorial tomorrow. But you can look at this paper, for example, which would tell you why this is more generic. 84. So let's compute f prime of k as a function of z. And again, f is written here. So this is a trivial calculation, a delta minus z to power delta minus minus 1 plus higher orders plus b delta plus jumps in front, z to power delta plus minus 1 plus higher orders in z. And downstairs, we have the same thing, of course, because nothing depends on z. Delta minus plus b epsilon delta plus iotas. And now remember that we are taking the limit of small. So we have to substitute. We compute this, right? And then we take z equal to epsilon in this expression. And then we take epsilon to 0. So epsilon is a small number. So how to deal with it is we can deal with it as follows. We take, so when z becomes epsilon, right, we want to expand this to small epsilon, right? And we take sort of the lowest term in epsilon, and the lowest term in epsilon will be this one here, right? So delta minus minus 1, right? That's the most singular piece in epsilon. We take it out of this whole expression, and we take out the most singular piece downstairs as well, right? So, and then the rest will have the form 1 plus something higher order in epsilon, and here we have 1 plus higher order in epsilon, which will expand for small epsilon. So the result of this is the following. So we have delta minus over epsilon. That's what survives of this ratio of two most singular terms. And here we have 1 plus higher orders, and then the coefficient in front of the this second term will be the ratio of delta plus and delta minus epsilon to power delta plus minus delta minus plus higher order pieces. And downstairs, it will be 1 plus and so on plus the ratio of b over a epsilon delta plus minus delta minus plus higher orders. And expansion of this further tells you that this is delta minus over epsilon. And here you have 1 plus various terms. And then finally, there is this coefficient b over a to multiplied by delta plus over delta minus minus 1. And then some power of epsilon, which is delta plus minus delta minus, plus higher terms in epsilon. So this bracket, right, so remember that we are only interested in non-trivial K dependence, non-trivial momentum dependence. Because all polynomial dependence in momentum will give us contact terms, and that will be discarded. So for example, if you have constant or contact terms, this will be in position space, this will be something which is proportional to delta of x or derivative of delta of x. So this term here will not interest us at all. In fact, if you want to be completely sort of rigorous, you have to include the holographic renormalization terms, and then these terms, like the first one here, will be removed automatically, right? But we can remove it by hand because we know that this is something which is proportional to k to power 0, and therefore is proportional to delta function in the position space. So this is a contact term. So we take out of this whole expression only the non-trivial k dependence, right? The non-trivial k dependence, the lowest one in epsilon, will start from this term here. Right, so it will be therefore, it will be B over A delta plus minus delta minus, and then some power of epsilon, which is delta plus delta minus minus one plus higher order terms, and this means that the correlator GR is proportional to this normalization factor, and then there will be some coefficient like delta plus, which is not very interesting, and then epsilon to some power, delta minus, minus one plus this alpha, and then there is a ratio of B over A, and I remind you that B over A are functions of momentum. So you can remember our calculation for the dilaton, where delta plus was equal to four, delta minus equal to zero, and so 4 minus 1 then equal to 3, and alpha was equal to minus 3, right? Remember, that was our alpha, right? Minus 3. So there would be no dependence on epsilon, and indeed, when we computed this correlator, there was no dependence on epsilon, but generically, there could be some, and that has to be, so one has to renormalize your operator O by including this appropriate power of epsilon, but so provided, right, so this is your correlator, so provided the ratio B over A is not a contact term, in other words, provided this ratio is not a polynomial in K, in which case it has to be discarded, and one has to go to higher and higher orders, looking for non-analytic dependence, meaning non-polynomial dependence on K. And if you find nothing, if you find that all coefficients will depend polynomially on K, that means that your correlator is trivial. It's equal to zero up to contact terms. But typically, you find something non-trivial very quickly, and that is given by this ratio B over A, rather generically. So I said this reminds you of a scalar case, but you can recast your fluctuation equation for graviton and for Maxwell field and other form fields in the form which is no different from philosophically, let's say no different from a scalar case, and therefore this conclusion, this structure, the construction here is fairly generic. Okay, so notice one thing, that your correlation two-point function of your operator O, which couples to field phi, is given essentially by the ratio of these two coefficients, A and B, which appear in the solution of the differential equation. I remind you that these coefficients do depend on the boundary conditions. So these coefficients are not, when you write down the solution, right, first you say, well, I have second order ODE, so I have two solutions, right, with arbitrary coefficients A and B, right? But they are arbitrary as long as you don't fix any boundary conditions. Once you fix boundary conditions, you have to specify what exactly these coefficients are, right? Because that's the whole point of solving the differential equation. So your boundary conditions dictate the exact form of the coefficients A and B, and A and B do depend on momentum and other parameters of your differential equation, like mass, for example, and so on. And they provide the non-trivial expression for the correlation function. So the observation is, which will be crucial for us, is very simple, that if you have zeros of A, because A depends on momentum, in principle it could be some complicated function, like the gamma function of momentum, or I mean some complicated function, but zeros of A will be the poles of GR, right, by construction. Okay? And zeros of K, so this is observation that will be extremely important for us. But zeros of A have also a different meaning in the when you consider these fluctuation fields in the GR. So let me finish with that maybe in 3 minutes. So but zeros of A of K have other meaning in GR. So so these are the zeros, the Dirichlet boundary conditions on the solution phi of z at the boundary of your space-time. So recall that phi has this form A, and then there is a lowest order in Z, right? And then there is some B to power delta plus, and so on, at the boundary. So these are called the quasi-normal modes in GR. So quasi-normal modes are solutions of linearized the ground equations of motion satisfying the incoming wave boundary condition at the horizon and Dirichlet condition at the boundary, or sometimes other boundary conditions depending on what kind of background you have. So for example, e.g. outgoing waves in asymptotically flat background. All right. So therefore, the quasi-normal spectra, so these are solutions, right? The modes are solutions, but quasi-normal spectra are determined by the condition A of K is equal to zero, or more specifically, so A is a function of omega, so our K is four dimensional, so it's omega and the K as a vector, right, equal to zero, and therefore solving this equation algebraically would give you the dependence of omega on K, and this is the dispersion relation, right? So okay, let me finish. So you have to solve this. So this is a set of equations. So for example, gamma function of some function of K is equal to zero, and you solve this, and you find the spectrum. So there are properties of the spectrum that you can try to classify. So typically, so usually, the spectrum is discrete. Similar to harmonic oscillator, And you have this omega n's with n going 1, 2, and 3, and so on to infinity. So for example, in four-dimensional Schwarzschild case, so this is known for a long time. So you look at the complex omega plane. So this is the real part of omega, and this is imaginary part of omega. This is zero. And you can compute this spectra numerically, or numerically at least. Well, you can analytically compute the asymptotics of the spectrum, but overall you have to resort to numerical means, and they lie on, so they are symmetric with respect to the imaginary part, imaginary axis, and they have this, so this shape which I try to reproduce, maybe not very artistically, but so the spectrum is discrete, but it lies on this kind of a curve up to infinity, right? And one can compute this asymptotic behavior here. That's first done by Lubosch Mottl. the conclusion, so this is an example for Schwarzschild. The spectra for, so this is flat space, right? So this is flat, asymptotically flat case where you impose, yep. Yeah, yeah. You have to analyze these things more carefully. So it's so the answer is no. So they don't coincide. But you have to do a little bit of analysis of differential equation to tell this that this is the case.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not. I mean, looking at this, you can say, oh yeah, how about singularities of B, for example, right? So they could also contribute. And then you can say, why only the zeros? Perhaps A has different type of singularities, and how about that, and so on. So all these cases could be considered as a case. But so this is kind of the main message of today's discussion is that once you know, so if you know that there are zeros of A, they will be the poles of G. That's a conclusion. Okay. And the last sentence today is that so the conclusion of all this discussion, the conclusion is let me write somewhere here. So the conclusion is the following, that the quasi-normal spectra appear in holography naturally as poles of G retarded, the function of, let's say, omega and k. But of course, we always keep in mind that this is all at strong coupling, the limit of strong coupling and infinite NC, right? So when we talk about the singularities of GR, so remember that our Green's function, our correlator GR, of course, generically is a function of lambda and a function of N as well. So what we are computing here is the limit of this correlation function when n is infinite and lambda is infinite. And there are corrections to this, of course. So this statement here refers to the situation in the limit of infinitely strong coupling and infinite nc. So the spectra of the dual background appear as poles of the correlation function, retarded correlation function in Lorentzian signature. And the poles, remember that what is the interpretation of the poles of the retarded correlator? So these are the excitations that could be elementary excitations in principle, or collective excitations if we are considering the state of matter, which is a condensed matter, like zero temperature, non-zero temperature, non-zero chemical potential, in the dual QFT. So, for example, phonons, namely the sound waves, in our TFT at finite temperature and perhaps finite chemical potential, but that is not necessary. Okay, so that's a statement, right? So again, I just let me recap what we did, right? So we had a recipe of how to compute the retarded correlation function from fluctuations of dual gravity background. And this recipe we used here generically for generic fluctuation phi. And we discovered that the correlator is proportional to the ratio of these coefficients B over A, which are determined by the solution of a differential equation. So this is non-trivial task. And the structure of this correlator is such that the zeros of A would correspond to the poles of the correlation function and are interpreted in the dual quantum field theory as elementary or collective excitations in your theory, for example, phonons. So we will see explicitly how they appear from dual gravity. But from the point of view of GR, we are simply talking about the things which were known from 1960. So these quasi-normal moles, I mean, this picture and so on. So all of this was considered from starting from Wheeler and other people in late 1960s. And there is a machinery in GR of how to compute all this and so on. So this is all very well known. But our statement is the following, that if we are interested in, so suppose you have a quantum field theory, for example, at finite temperature and density, and we want to look at what kind of quasi-particles you have in this theory, right? So the moral of this calculation is that you don't have to compute the correlators or kind of bother with action and so on. All you have to do is to look at the quasi-normal frequencies of your dual gravity background. If you know what the background is, you consider the quasi-normal spectra of the particular fields which couple to a certain operator. So for example, H mu nu, the graviton will couple to T mu nu, A mu, the Maxwell field will couple to the current J mu, and so on. So you consider the quasi-normal spectra, typically they are known, or you can fairly easily compute them, maybe numerically, and you look at the spectra and you see a picture of this type, and it gives you the answer what kind of quasi-particle excitations they are in your QFT in the limit of infinite coupling, infinite n. Sometimes you find interesting excitations, such as the excitations which are governed by generic principles of quantum field theory at low energy, for example, the hydro type, the fluid dynamic fluctuations, such as sound and diffusion and so on. And this is something that we'll analyze tomorrow in great detail. But the moral of the story is that all of this is encoded by in the dual gravity. So somehow your black brains or black holes, they know about the sound, they know about diffusion and so on by virtue of this correspondence between quasi-normal modes and the poles of the retarded correlator. Okay? So we'll see tomorrow how this works in a particular example.